Number one in the series, Atonement and Your Picture of God, by Dr. Graham Maxwell. Recorded at the San Diego Forum on May 8, 1993.
I hope you won't misunderstand this. It's not my luggage for all night. My mother used to say, "Why do you take all those books to meetings? Surely you're not going to use them all, are you?" And sometimes I do. It's just I've learned that when you come to the forum, you better bring your evidence. So I did. Hardly anybody has a coat. Is it permissible? The last time I spoke on Molokai, they had just built the church. The Maranatha people had built a whole church in 3 weeks. It was really quite incredible. And when I approached the door, I noticed there were shoes outside, rows and rows of shoes. It was all right to take your shoes off if you were hot, but not your coat. The pastor explained they were trying to teach reverence in the church. It was perfectly reverent to remove your shoes. But then somebody told me that if you cool your feet, it's more effective than cooling the rest of you. Is there anything to that? So I had to preach with my coat on and no shoes. First time I've done that. Since I've been a teacher for 51 years now, I always look forward to meetings where there's a lot of discussion of all kinds. My main concern is that our time spent together be very useful. And I'm reminded of a meeting I went to in Berkeley years ago, and Paul Tillich was the speaker. It was the annual meeting called the Earl Lecture Series. Over 2,600 clergymen of all faiths meet once a year in Berkeley at the Pacific School of Religion and bring in distinguished speakers from all over the world. And Dr. Tillich was explaining what he thought was wrong with the efforts of the church to spread the good news. He said, "I think the trouble is that the church too often is answering questions that nobody's asking." And he outlined that for 3 days in an interesting way. Well, I don't want to answer questions that nobody's asking, so the sooner we get to the questions, the better. But first of all, I would like to present a general background against which to maybe raise some of these questions. I must confess that I originally thought of submitting the title, "The Lengthening Shadow of Hell," on the doctrine of the atonement, but I thought that might not look too good elsewhere without an explanation. But I believe it has a lot to do with it, a great deal to do with it. So I chose rather how one's perception of God affects one's understanding of the atonement. And I'd like to begin by clarifying something in the newsletter. On the back side it says, "The SDA Bible Commentary discussion on Romans is his contribution, although he notes that editing changed the meaning of some of what was submitted for publication." Not in the first edition. Later. We had the privilege, Elder Nickel only did it for me, and perhaps Dr. Horn, I'm sure Elder Cottrell, I was allowed to read the galleys, and I agreed that what they had in the galleys was all right. It didn't mean I had to agree with every point. I submitted to their plan that Elder Nickel worked out so carefully that the commentary would not represent the thinking of any one person, but it would represent consensus at the time. And while we were allowed considerable freedom, nevertheless, we were not to strike out in some new direction on our own. And so you read something in the first edition of the SDA Bible Commentary. It was thought to represent consensus at the time. About 20 years later, there came an urgent letter from Australia to the president of the General Conference, Neil Wilson. And it said, "How is it that the commentary teaches that God had to be reconciled to man?" And Elder Nickel immediately consulted one of the editors of the review. I'm sure he'd love to have gone and talked to Elder Nickel, but he's no longer with us. So he went to the person who's had actually more to do with the commentary than any other single person, and that's Raymond Cottrell. He wrote 2,000 pages, plus editing the whole thing. A very extraordinary gentleman. He's come to talk to you, hasn't he, several times. Well, he said, "What's that you say? The commentary is supposed to say that God was reconciled to man?" "Yes, Romans 5:10. So Elder Cottrell said, "Well, that's not the way it read when we printed it." So he said, "Maybe I'd had something to do with it." And he phoned me in Loma Linda. He said, "What's this change you made in the commentary? That isn't the way it read when we agreed on consensus." Well, I said, "It certainly didn't enjoy such a change under my influence, I can tell you. But I had to run down to the Adventist Book Center and buy the Revised Version. That's what's in this heavy case. Well, there's the original. And here are the Revised. Now, let's see first. Romans 5:10. Well, that's where there's reference to reconciliation in Romans 5. And the second paragraph under reconciled read like this. The Bible nowhere speaks of God being reconciled to man. It is true that the death of Christ made it possible for God to do for man what he otherwise could not have done. And lower down, but this does not mean that God needed to be reconciled. The alienation was entirely on man's part. And that was screened, and that was consensus at the time. But then I picked up the Revised one. Romans 5:10. Well, it fits exactly the same. If there's a change, it's a work of art. It's exactly the same space. But instead of saying the Bible nowhere speaks, if it says the Bible elsewhere mentions God's being reconciled to man. But the text is the same one. God was in Christ reconciling the world unto himself. They came up with no text saying that God was reconciled to man, but God was in Christ reconciling man to himself. And then it left out the fact that the alienation was on man's part. Well, then I wondered, what about another place? You see, Corinthians has this text, God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself. I wonder if that was changed too. I looked over here. In Corinthians, Dr. Ted Heppenstall wrote this. You know his theology. Here's how he wrote it. Reconciliation involves no change on God's part, for God never changes. It is not God who needs to be reconciled to man, but man who needs to be reconciled to God. There has never been enmity on God's part. Men sometimes conceive of God as a stern judge, angry with sinners, hard to be placated, unmerciful, ready to condemn. This characterization misrepresents him and is an affront to him. Christ did not have to go to the cross in order to appease God, but as a demonstration of his love. God did not demand the death of his son, but gave him out of a heart of infinite love. And the end of that section is, reconciliation removes the enmity by means of a substitutionary fulfillment of the law's requirements. Well, I wondered if that was changed. And I looked over. Here's how it reads. Reconciled us to himself. Here the thought is expressed that it is man who needs to be reconciled to God. However, it is also true that God needed to be reconciled to man. Sin had brought a separation between God and man, and this gap was bridged by Christ, who reconciled not only man to God, but also God to man. So we immediately began a detective search to find out if this had been authorized. And after years of investigation, nothing has ever been found. Nobody knows how this happened. And nobody has come forward to admit doing it. Certainly the editors had nothing to do with it. And if you know how things occur in the publishing house, things like that cannot happen without some editorial agreement that it ought to be done. It just cannot happen. It could only be if some soul of real conviction had somewhere in the printing process done a masterful work. It fits exactly the space. It's just amazing. Had done it. So I told this story at the Pacific Press, and afterwards several came up and said, we've guessed who did it. But so far I haven't had the nerve to go see him. It may be, you see, it may be wrong. It may be quite wrong. It's just nobody knows. But the search went on in some interesting ways. To make a long story short, I got a letter the other day recognizing that this was unauthorized change. And it will be corrected, part way back at least to the original. For there is no verse in the Bible that says God had to be reconciled to man. It doesn't exist in the Bible. No one's found one yet. It would be used if there were such. That's not all, though. Along with the commentary on Romans and Corinthians, as far as is known, this is the only change in the text of the SDA Bible commentary. There has been no other change. In the introductory chapters, yes, but not in the exposition of the rest of the seven volumes. But no changes have been authorized, of any kind whatever. And that's a wonderful mystery as to how that got in. But if you will look in the Bible dictionary now, which in the same set is volume 8, and you look up atonement, and it's a wonderful article. Now, I'm showing my colors when I say it's a wonderful article. Well, I haven't said how it reads, but now you will know. First of all, it explains the meaning of the word atonement, which I'll say more about later, and I fully agree with the meaning of the word. Understood in terms of its original meaning, atonement properly denotes a state of reconciliation that terminated a state of estrangement and was thus reasonably close in meaning to the biblical terms it was used to translate. However, the word atonement has acquired the special technical theological meaning of propitiation or expiation, and when so used, implies that the sacrifice of Christ on the cross constituted reparation to an offended God. This concept reflects the pagan idea of propitiating an offended deity in order to avert his anger and vengeance, and assumes that God must be reconciled to us. Thus today, the word atonement does not properly convey either its own original meaning, the state of being at one, or the sense of the Hebrew and Greek terms thus translated. But the article continues. No change is necessary on God's part in order to effect the reconciliation. It is the sinner who must be covered, that's the Hebrew word, that's translated atonement sometimes. It is the sinner who must be covered or reconciled to God, not God with respect to the sinner. And I wondered, you know, the Bible dictionary has been revised. Here's the revised edition. You can tell by the different binding. And so you look it up and you'd think, since it's volume 8 of the Bible commentary series, the individual who showed really great skill in making the change in the other two places would surely do the same here. Here we are, the dictionary. Atonement. Exactly the same. He forgot to change it in the Bible dictionary. So the way it is now, volume 8 of the Bible commentary series is in direct opposition to the volume 6 that contains the comments on Romans and Corinthians. Now, which one is authentic? Well, it's an interesting dilemma for people to deal with. But if plans go through, the contradiction will be eliminated in the near future. And maybe I shouldn't have mentioned it, because the hope is that this will all be done very gracefully. Perhaps done as secretly as it was done the first time, I don't know. One doesn't want to start a battle over this subject. You see, if the word atonement means unity, harmony, being at one, to have a hostile discussion over the atonement is a total contradiction. It cannot be done. So if we should deteriorate into an argument over the atonement that isn't in the kindest, most gracious, respectful atmosphere, we are denying the atonement while we do it. And that's the real meaning of the word. Yes. It's tens of thousands. In fact, they sent 500 full sets to Russia with the wrong picture. And the Russians don't need to have that view. But anyway, we're getting ahead of the subject and being maybe a little prejudicial here. I went over to point it out to Dr. Heppenstall. I knew he would be interested in it. But he's not as vigorous as he used to be, and while he reacted a little bit that the thought that somebody would change what he had written was of interest to him. But I've wondered if he had got the information 30 years ago. You remember? I've always admired him for his fire. He and I have discussed the subject of the forensic, if you forgive the term, aspects of justification and the atonement and so forth for decades together. But always in the best possible atmosphere. I remember one time he came for a week of prayer at Pacific Union College, and by Wednesday afternoon, he was rather weary from counseling all night and preaching all day, as he did. He said, let's go out and have some exercise. So we went down to the golf course in Sonoma. And we were discussing, of course, the forensic aspects of justification. We came to one fairway that was par 5. That means it's over 500 yards. And we took our modest little drives, and then we set out after our balls, discussing the forensic aspects of the atonement. When we finally arrived at the putting surface 500 yards away, we realized with all modesty that we had not driven the ball that far. Not even that extraordinary John Daly can do that. We'd been discussing our theology so much we had overlooked our balls. So we had to turn around and go back, apologizing to the folk behind us. We're just looking for our ball. That's the way it's been with him, and I always enjoyed it. Not long ago we had a discussion and said, wouldn't it be a shame to lose one's admission to the kingdom because of losing one's goodwill discussing the plan of salvation? Inconceivable. I'm willing to leave room for this, that... You know, we might say, well, we're never going to agree fully on this. Why don't we wait till we get to heaven and we'll ask the Lord? All right, we'll do that. So when we get there, we'll both go up to him and say, settle it once and for all. What is the true view? Which one of us is right? And the Lord very kindly smiles at both of us and says, well, actually, you both were wrong. One would have to be prepared to accept that, wouldn't one? Or would you say, Lord, you're wrong too? Maybe I've come to the wrong place. So one had better remain willing to accept correction and instruction right to the end. Well, the change is very important to some. A while ago, I was asked to write the article in the Review and Herald when we went through the 27 doctrines a while ago, and I was asked to do the one on the Father. And regrettably, there were many, many changes made in that article. I even included the story of the change in the commentary, and I made the point that somebody, surely in all sincerity, and must have been a person of great conviction, had ventured to make this change. And I had respect for the person's conviction, but people needed to be aware of the change. But it was edited out, along with some other things. I don't know if you remember the article. And so the story has not got out. It will, of course, when the next edition comes out, perhaps, and the change has been made back. I recognize that this matter of whether or not God has to be reconciled to us is a matter of great importance to some. But even those who most sincerely and earnestly hold the view admit there is no text in the Bible that says God has to be reconciled to us. But God was in Christ reconciling the world unto himself. The thought being that the purpose of the atonement was to affect not only us, but also God. And if a person believes that only man needed to be affected, that is loosely called the moral influence theory. But if it is believed that God also needed to be influenced and affected by the atonement, that's regarded by some as orthodoxy. The charge that some hold the moral influence theory is very, very loosely leveled. If you've really studied the moral influence theory and gone back to Mr. Abelard and all the rest, you don't have to read Mr. Abelard to come up with an understanding that God did not need to be reconciled to us. Abelard did not see things the way we Adventists do. He never had a great controversy. He never had questions about the character of God that had to be answered before the universe could go on trusting God and all those great subjects. So to suggest that some of us would be influenced by Abelard, as you may have heard, is simply absolutely fallacious and unsupported by the evidence. I'll show you rather how it can be arrived at. Now, recognizing how keenly some feel, I could bring you some letters out of my briefcase that will say that if you do not believe that the atonement was designed to influence God as well as man, you should not be allowed to preach in the Seventh-day Adventist pulpit. Strong words like that. So, what are we talking about? I feel that the first thing to do, since atonement means friendship, being at peace with those who have different views, the first thing one needs to do is to try to understand why it is so important to some that God himself must also be changed by the atonement. Recognizing that this could be most sincerely prayed about by some. And some would be praying that I would see it that way, and others of us who don't would. So I recognize that sincerity. Now, I dealt with this in Servants or Friends in the book, if you have it. But since I did not use the customary dark speech, and I explain that in the book, what dark speech is, some may not recognize the explanation of the atonement. See, there is no word for atonement in the Bible. Most of the terms of traditional Christian theology are not in the Bible. The Bible is in Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek, and most of these terms are Latin-based terms. And you won't find them in there.